Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is The Compliance Guide.
The Compliance Guide.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is The Compliance Guide. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to this episode of The Compliance Guy Monday Coding and Compliance Roundtable. We are live right now. I know it's been a couple of weeks. What this would be, if we didn't do it this week, this would be 3 weeks since our last gathering together. So I know there's been some questions as to whether or not I was still alive and whether or not I was suffering from some kind of affliction because I have not been present on LinkedIn. I've not been blogging. I've not been doing much of anything. But here's the deal. For the last 2 weeks, I have been engaged in multiple civil and criminal trials. I've been involved in peer review hearings. I've been involved in administrative law judge reviews. And I finally got to a point where I needed a break. So I went away for a few days. So while I know some of you enjoy my blogs and posts, I apologize, but it's been a crazy 2 weeks. So with that said, I'm going to welcome to the program my esteemed colleagues, Christine Hall, Terry Fletcher, Paul Spencer, Stephanie Allard, Scott Kraft. In no particular order have I named their names. So we have a great program lined up for y'all today. I think we want to go ahead and start with Terry. So Terry, because you always say we talk about so many other things that we never get to you in time. So I want to start with you. You had a couple of really good topics that you brought up to us. And I want to start with the very first one, which is, does how much a practice charge affect anything related to fraud, waste, and abuse? Most practices are at 200 to 250% of allowed charges. Does that create a problem? So let me pause and let me turn it over to you.
Well, and these, you know, my topics today were kind of short, but it was just something I thought would be helpful to bring to the roundtable because, and I apologize, everyone, I'm on cough drops. I'm recovering from a chest cold, but I've been recently engaged with an attorney that was asking some questions regarding charges, and I thought it was interesting because it was commercial claims versus Medicare claims, and you know, Medicare, if you're a participating provider, doesn't seem to care what you charge. Their allowable is going to stay about the same, and to her point, she was saying, yes, but doesn't the doctor do it to think they can slide in and get paid 100% of something? I said, no, they charge what they charge because they want to show what their services are of value to them. And then also commercial plans, typically, now I'm seeing the opposite on occasion, typically pay more than the Medicare allowable. And obviously you don't want to get downgraded as far as what your reimbursement is. But to her point, she was saying that this could make a physician look like they were doing something shady if they're charging, let's say, $20,000 for a procedure when the allowable is only $7,000. And I do see providers more and more starting to charge 300, 400, 500% of Medicare. And I'm seeing some of these PE groups, private equity groups, that are telling them to do so, saying that, oh, well, we can negotiate a rate, just charge it. And then there's this funny thing. I don't know if, so those of you that aren't in California, we have this this insurance that floats out here, it's called Screen Actors Guild, and they pay what you bill. They don't pay. There's no allowables or anything. If you bill something to them, which obviously who has that? Celebrities. Then they reimburse what you actually bill. That's not the typical how insurance works. So whenever you get a patient, I know that calls in, obviously Beverly Hills, Los Angeles area that has that insurance, I bet the doctors are knocking down doors, finding rooms, moving patients to the side, saying, I want that patient. We offer foot massages, cappuccinos, you betcha, whatever you want. But that's not typical. there's always going to be a PPO, EPO, contract adjustment, you know, things like that and negotiated. So I'm going to put it out to the roundtable. Do you feel that it's not just a bad optic, but do you feel that it applies or implies, I should say, that a doctor is doing something shady or it's a bad optic if they charge too much? I don't know the answer to that. I think it's interesting.
I tend to think that it is I tend to think that it's just an information vacuum. I once dealt with a neurosurgeon who, and you can imagine the type of CPT codes that go out on one claim for a major back surgery, setting his fee schedule 10 times Medicare. You know, and you know, and wondering why he wasn't getting paid. It's like, well, you know, it's not the size of the fee schedule; it's the size of the allowed amounts that you're getting paid. So, all it really does when you inflate your fee schedule is it just inflates your AR needlessly for 0 to 120 days. You know, he was looking at. You know, he looks at a simple financial report and it looks like he's got millions of dollars waiting in insurance payments. Well, no, you've got millions of dollars in charges and you've got about this much waiting in insurance payments. So, you know, there are ways in the modern age to build a defensible fee schedule. And it has to take into account geography. It has to take into account specialty and it has to take into account, allowable RVUs for your area and probably something that's going to be a very hot topic in certain states, malpractice insurance claims as well.
Well, I wanted to jump in real quick because we were talking earlier. Today is the last day to comment on the fee schedule, the Medicare proposed fee schedule. And in the beginning, when I was reading it, trying to get through all the 2,200 something pages. I noticed that there were a lot of comments that CMS didn't receive invoices to prove that there was an increase in the cost of things, because that all factors into how that fee schedule gets allocated every single year, how we factor in what is the actual cost. And for those of you that don't know, there's a huge, huge database of what everything costs, malpractice, by geographic location, but that information only gets updated when we tell CMS that we've had an increase, right? So really important for us to be part of that. That's all I got.
Oh, my turn. Okay. So one of the things that I just think of, because we've had some projects we've had to work with. Sorry, I thought I might be muted there. I can't help but think about the patients in this situation, because there's so many people who do not understand our industry, not even a little bit. So, you know, a patient may be calling up or Googling looking for a surgeon, for example. I know that I've seen this more in the surgery side. And how do they know the differences? Do they even know to check with their insurance who's in network, who's out of network? And, you know, I had an interesting situation more so with diagnostic testing recently, but I had a friend reach out to me because she was really frustrated that she was being charged, I think, over $200 for a test that, based on her policy, if the scenario and the diagnosis was supported, would have been covered under her preventative part of her plan. But with what was happening and everything that was done prior, the exams done prior, they did have the right to bill out the diagnostic portion as opposed to a screening test. So, you know, she had no idea what was even going on. She felt like she was in the dark on everything because nothing was explained to her. You know, one of the things that I had to talk through with her that a lot of people don't understand is that it really is the patient's responsibility as far as prior authorizations, or not authorizations, but knowing ahead of time, you know, what could be covered. And that I often see that language even built into information that's coming from the payer, that, you know, it's the patient's responsibility. And while that may be the fact, who is actually paying attention to that? Who's educating the patients about this? So when we have these surgeons who don't participate because they don't want to be bound by contracts, you know, Paul, I know you and I had one, I can't remember the specialty, but he's like, ignore, you know, all NCCI edits. They didn't want anything followed. They wanted every little tiny thing pieced apart, billed for, and then they were billing it at a crazy high amount when under insurance contracts, you know, a majority of that would have been bundled. So yeah, from the technical side, they can do that. But then, you know, we have this gray area and it's not defined. Like, what are the ethics? What are the morals? Who's helping patients understand when you step into this practice that that's going to be the reality when you could go down the street and, you know, have that covered at a higher rate?
Well, I think the other thing, just to kind of move on to the next topic here, one thing that's tough too, I think, with understanding, especially when this comes from an attorney asking this question to me, patients, I would say for the most part, you know, we hear all about this transparency in the hospital, they have to say what's being charged. Patients just want to know what they're charged. Honestly, I don't see many patients that are like, well, this MRI is $8,000 at this hospital, it's only $4,000 at this hospital. But if they're only charged $20 at each place, they don't care. They just want to know what their out-of-pocket's going to be. Now, I'm not saying there's not that patient that thinks, well, that's too much. I agree. I mean, it would be me. I'd be like, that's ridiculous. But that's because I'm in the industry. I think that patients are more concerned about what they charge. But I guess my question is, and again, this was a malpractice attorney, what concerned me is they're looking for optics to discredit the physician. And one of them was overcharging. And I thought that was interesting because whose opinion is that in overcharging? And what goes into, like Christine and Paul mentioned, what goes into a fee schedule creation? You know, do you have to defend it? Like, what goes into our documentation for our services? Or do you just say, well, I'm just doing 2,000% of Medicare or whatever? I mean, do you have to say what is going into your thought process? And I'll leave it at that and we can move on to the next one.
So before we go, I have a couple of thoughts. I may come at this from a slightly different perspective. I think there's a lot of things that have to be taken into consideration, right? One, the Medicare economic index. Two, the inflationary state of the country. Everything is more expensive right now. But here's my thoughts on physician fee schedules. The rates that many of these providers are getting for services that they're rendering don't cover the costs associated for providing the service in the first place. Physicians have to do a better job of negotiating their contracts. And I hear a lot of people say to me, but Sean, the insurance company's not going to negotiate with me. Yes, they will. And there's a lot of factors that drives an insurance company to the table, such as being in a health professional shortage area, having a higher medical grade score than your peers, offering services that aren't offered by others that are well within the realm of your specialty. And the list can go on and on. But here's the main point. Physicians need to create a fee schedule that when they go back to an insurance company at the point of their rollover. So most insurance companies will say, if you're going to negotiate your contract or you're going to terminate, it needs to be within 90 days of the expiration. You need to be able to go back to them and say, listen, here's our current fee schedule that we're being reimbursed under based on your allowed amount. Here's what our actual practice fee schedule is, and it's based on a more realistic outcome of what our costs are in order to render these services and or procedures to your beneficiaries. We need a raise. And that's where you start. I just had a practice here. Paul knows who the client is. We went back to the insurance company in the Atlanta market, and we told the insurance company, my client's done. They no longer wish to participate with your insurance company for a number of reasons, but mainly because your rates are absolutely atrocious. We're done. Here is your 30-day notice. Do you know that they asked us to get onto a phone call and they said to us, we can't afford to lose you guys from the Atlanta market. This is Atlanta. And we got our raise. And it was a right thing to do. Again, I go back and what I tell folks, apparently there's something going on with my microphone. And if I sound like I'm sucking on a helium balloon, I don't know what to tell you. I apologize. But anyways, bottom line is this. You've got to create a realistic fee schedule. I agree with Paul Spencer 100% that when you have an overinflated fee schedule, you overinflate your AR. And it forces you to either take your write-offs on the front end or on the back end. But if you just allow it to sit, you're misstating your actual receivables. So be smart about this stuff. Okay, so I don't embarrass myself any further sounding like somebody on helium. I will give it to somebody who doesn't sound like that, Scott Kraft. Here you go.
Now I have to hope I don't sound like that. I think your point was very good. A couple of points that I wanted to make about the whole issue of fee schedules is, you know, to me, like, I think basing a fee schedule on your actual costs is very smart. One of the challenges that I talk about with practices sometimes when the fee schedules are inflated are really twofold. One, the more like dead money you have rattling around in your financials, the easier it is for somebody to hide their financial malfeasance in that number. So if you're carrying a very bloated AR number, even as you know it's fake money, right? So this is all this money that you know you're going to write off once the claim gets processed, but those dollar amounts are so high, at that point, it does become a little bit easier for somebody who has malicious intent to be able to manipulate any activities they might be doing within that fee schedule. The second thing that I would say with regard to fee schedules is, and it always kind of surprises me when this comes up, is whatever your philosophy is going to be fee schedule wise, as an organization, you should understand the implications of that and remain sort of true to that understanding. And so what I mean is, I have a number of clients who will adopt the approach that we've talked a little bit about, where the fee schedule is a multiple of a multiple of Medicare. And so they have a pretty large kind of rolling AR that falls off as the claims get processed. But then somebody in the finance department will see the number and freak out. And I'll have practices say things to me like, well, why don't we just adjust the fees for that specific payer to match their allowable so that we can just clean that up, you know, and so that the number doesn't look as bad, right? And of course, that causes all manner of other contractual problems. You know, and in my world, one of the things that I on my nice to have list would be, if a payer agrees to pay a certain amount for a service, they shouldn't be as obsessed with this idea of like either a favored nation or a comparison to the charges, right? Like if you agree to pay for it at a certain rate, like that's what you're paying for. And I think a lot of what happens with fee schedules is it becomes a little bit of a thoughtless exercise in terms of, let's just make sure we set it high enough that we don't have to babysit it to make sure that we don't have a fee that climbs over it. But, you know, I do think those are a couple of implications that you see. In addition to things like, how do you work in like prompt pay discounts when somebody actually doesn't have a plan and suddenly you're telling them they owe, you know, five times what everybody else is going to be paying for that service.
Sean, hello.
Okay. So I agree with everybody's point. I think, you know, if you are creating a fee schedule, you know, something that's two and a half times Medicare's fee schedule, I think that's reasonable. You know, depending on your geographic location, if you're in an area like, you know, Los Angeles, you're in an area like New York or Boston where cost of living is exorbitant, then, you know, 300% of RBRVS is appropriate. Again, I just believe that you need to do the analysis, you need to be smart, and you need to pay close attention to what your costs are commensurate to what you're being reimbursed from the insurance companies, and don't be afraid to negotiate these things. All right, I think that was a great first topic of conversation, so I want to go to our second topic, and I want to go to Stephanie to kick us off on this one. And I kind of played around with the mic a little bit. Do I still sound like a helium balloon is in my lungs?
No,
oh, so I fixed it. Fantastic. Okay. Either that or you guys are just breaking my chops. All right. So I want to talk about, Stephanie, what you refer to as a pulse check and external audits. So let me pause there because I think that's enough bait, or what they call clickbait, to get folks interested in this conversation.
Okay. So I brought this to our panel here because I've seen and heard some really weird things in just the past couple of weeks. And, you know, we are more than halfway through 2023. We're looking to the last quarter of this year. And I still have some really odd things being said about the 2021 guidelines, which in the office setting, we should be, you know, headed in a better direction at this point. So just to give you an idea, some of the stuff that's been said to me recently with one group, for example, after looking at some examples to create education to go through the guidelines with the group, I was asked things like, oh, you know, I did a medication today, but I also ordered one lab. I thought that was an automatic level 4. Well, this was pediatrics. So that's going to be happening with pretty much everybody coming in with some kind of infection that needs an antibiotic. And a lot of us are probably very familiar with the fact that the majority of those patients actually have a low level presenting problem. So, you know, they have this wrong idea on the guidelines, and then they were upcoding because of it, which wasn't good. Some of the other things I've been told are based on the specialty itself. So for an example, you know, saying I'm this type of surgeon, so for that reason, our starting point is always a level 4. And, you know, it's just, I shouldn't be surprised, but I was very shocked to hear these types of things. And, you know, it just brings to mind that when I work with clients on this, that, you know, a lot of times we end up in our own bubbles, our own little worlds. I know that I do it myself when I'm working with my clients, different specialties, different projects. And it's really important to get out there and get outside perspective. Even if you have internal coders, you may even have internal auditors. There's no way to know that you're in the right place or the right mindset with some of these things if you're not checking outside of yourself. One of the clients who was making some comments like that, I also noticed that the language inside of the EMR system was saying level 4 service for detailed history, detailed exam, and low medical decision making. So one of the first questions I asked after that audit was, what are the capabilities of their EMR system? And is the provider coding for themselves or relying on the EMR? And one of the physicians was relying on an EMR that's still set to 95, 97. So, you know, there's so many examples of where this goes wrong. One last thing I'll say before I hand this over, you know, another area where it's really important to get outside input is what your physicians, what the owners of the practice, what the board, with the partners, whatever the situation is telling you to do, you know, is that compliant and is it even legal? It was somewhat a casual conversation until I found out what they were saying. Then I had extreme concern. And I was being asked, you know, what the process should be when they have internal findings similar to mine and they bring it to a physician. What is the process to correct that? Because the physicians are just saying, oh, can you go in and delete that part out for me then if it's not right? Or can you add something for me if that's what's needed here or there? Now, you know, to us, it's shocking. They felt it was wrong. But when the physician owns the practice, the physician signs your paycheck and all of these things, and you're in your little world, you know, how far are you actually questioning it? Do you feel like your job, you know, may be in jeopardy if you push back on this? And one of the conversations that we had to have at that point is stop it immediately. Don't continue. You shouldn't have the capability in your EMR. And, you know, you'll have to address that with that physician later on, but you have to protect yourself as well. Okay, who wants to talk on that next? I'm sure we all have a lot of experiences in this area.
I'll just make one comment and then I'll pass it along. That's a lot to say, Stephanie. That's a lot to unpack there. I think the biggest,
it's frightening.
It really is, because I get requests from providers all the time saying, you know, we're getting requests for an audit. We just went back and looked at our records, and I went ahead and, not me, this is what they tell me, so I'm air quoting, I went ahead and deleted what they said was wrong, and I restated. I was like, wait, you did what? And they said, I know Paul's just can't, his head's going to fall off, but it was just like, what did you do? And they said they deleted the problem, re-entered it. And I was like, you can't delete something that's already been billed, that's already gone out, that's already, I mean, somebody's seen it. That's why you're getting into trouble or be getting an inquiry for trouble. And he's like, well, I didn't mean to say that. I don't know how that got in the record. I'm like, well, then you're going to have to explain it. That's why you're getting the inquiry. They want to know why it looks like that. And I said, now that you've deleted it, and by the way, your EMR has a timestamp, you just ruined the whole thing. Now they're going to look and say, what else are you deleting? What else are you doing? You just gave yourself up for that. But I also see providers now saying, when it comes to education, because I know Stephanie and I have talked about this, I get this all the time from either the providers or the administrators. Terry, can you do an education program for us? And I'm like, sure. But we want to limit it. We just want you to tell us how to document and code a level 5. No. Or can you just do a education for the level 3 hospital visit? That would be no. If you want me to show you how to code and document individual hospital visits collectively, yes, we'll look at each scenario and is this type of patients. But those of you out there that get that request, you should absolutely say no, because you are basically pigeonholing that person to just show them how to upcode. And I know, Christine, you've got something to say on this, so I'll defer to you on that. Oh my gosh.
Well, no, I was thinking when Stephanie was talking, and then again with you, Terry, is, you know, we have a lot of mechanisms that will allow us to go in and see what our peers are doing. And I think that speaks to those endocrinologists, oncologists who say everything is a level 5. Everything is not a level 5. Because remember that when we're looking at reimbursement, we're looking at what happened today. So we wouldn't expect that every patient that's coming in to see you today is dying or that type of acuity, right? We would think that sometimes they're getting better. Sometimes it's just maintenance. Sometimes it's, right? So that should be reflective. And by reviewing maybe your comparative billing reports or doing your compliance risk assessments, you're going to be able to see where your vulnerability is and be able to focus in there. That's what's more important. It's not that you're going to get a level 5 every single time. You're going to see those few and far between if you're a good doctor, I would imagine. But that's a great place to start, is take a look at what's going on with other peers of your same specialty in your geographic area and kind of look at it from that perspective. But yeah, Terry, I'm seeing a lot of education requests to say, how do we meet this level? Well, in all honesty, you probably never will be able to have all 5s because you're taking care of your patients. You're making a difference. You're keeping them in a maintenance. So that's what I agree with everybody.
So real quick, let me take this from a slightly different perspective again. So I get to spend more than 200 days a year in federal court or in administrative procedures. And while I know that physicians believe every single patient deserves a certain level of care, and that should translate to a certain level of service, comparative billing reports are vital for a number of reasons. One, and one of the most important reasons, is because it gives you a snapshot of what's transpiring in your geographic region amongst your peers of the same specialty. Doesn't mean that they're coding correctly or incorrectly. It's a snapshot of what providers in your market are coding. Now, if you're an outlier, or you're showing aberrance to your patterns, it doesn't mean that you're wrong. It means that you need to ensure that you are painting a clear picture for each and every single encounter for what transpired between you and that patient. Simply believing that you get to bill a level 4 or level 5 for every single patient visit because you're a rheumatologist or you're an oncologist or you're an endocrinologist or you're an some kind of ologist is just plain ignorant. You code your services based on what transpired during the course of that encounter. You use your clinical judgment. You use medical necessity. You determine the appropriateness and the reasonableness of the services. Folks, you may not like the things that this panel is saying. You might not necessarily like the things that I'm saying. But what I can tell you is, as somebody who sits in the big chair more times throughout the course of a year than I wish that I did, I know what the prosecutors are going after. I know what the juries are listening to and what they understand to be based on someone's character, based on believability, based on an ability to explain to them in lay terms why something transpired. Folks, we live in a very different era right now than we did prior to the public health emergency. It's not changing. It's not going back to the way things used to be. The payers, all payers, commercial payers, government payers, investigating entities on behalf of the payers have taken a very aggressive approach and very aggressive stance to providers and what they're coding and billing. Monitor your billing reports. Monitor your documentation, but most importantly, make sure you have a corporate compliance program that is something more than just a template that actually speaks to the specifics of how you are doing things. Because at the end of the day, it's up to you and your organization to be able to demonstrate to a prosecutor that you have created a culture of compliance within your organization. Remember, they don't expect you to get every single thing correct every single time, but they expect you to demonstrate a good faith effort to doing so. All right, let me pause there. Scott, you've been pretty quiet today, and I know that you have taken on some compliance responsibilities, and I think it's critical. We'll talk about this for just a couple of minutes, and then we'll move to our next couple of topics.
Yes, I think culture, I'm glad you use that word at the end, because I talk about that sometimes when we do these sessions, and the organizational culture that you set with respect to how different people, whether it's a provider or, you know, a biller, an internal auditor, receive and give feedback. And, you know, one of the things that Stephanie talked a little bit about was external audit. And it always sounds a little bit self-serving when we mention it on these calls. I don't think it is, because there's external auditors throughout the country, but it is like another opinion. And it breaks through some of that organizational culture that we talked about. If you as an internal person don't feel that your voice is being heard based on things that you're seeing, having that external voice to come in, you know, I say half jokingly sometimes that the nice thing is, you know, I'm going to deliver my findings and then I don't have to worry about, you know, coming back in the next day necessarily, right? I don't have to hear the fallout from that, and I can be candid about what I think. And, you know, I think when you're working as an internal person in an organization, you have to think about culture of compliance with regard to your own employment, right? Like if you know that you're giving good faith, accurate advice to a provider who's ignoring it and saying, well, I'm an insert ologist or something like that, you know, whatever you're getting paid is not going to be worth it when the rubber hits the road, right? And so I think in those instances, you have to be thoughtful about what the best situation is for you, because culture to me is important. Like when you step into organizations, I mean, all of us on this panel have stepped into so many organizations over the years that you just see dozens upon dozens of different ways that practices operate, for better or for worse. There are many ways to do it right. There's many ways to do it wrong. And, you know, that's always one of the first things that I try to look at when I'm in a practice. Like, what is the culture of how people interact? If I'm, you know, a coder and I'm giving, you know, feedback to a provider and the provider just shuts that person down, even if the provider may be in the right in that specific instance, it creates sort of a chilling impact on feedback, right? So you want to be able to have open conversations about the right way to do things. You want to look at your comparative billing reports and not say we have to conform to that, but get an understanding of what you're doing that's different and how it's justifiable and defendable. So obviously I put a lot in there, but you know, I do want to bring it back to that idea of culture, that idea of everybody in an organization should be able to have those discussions candidly about what the compliant way is to build things, particularly when, I mean, I've seen the same thing as Stephanie has seen. I've seen misapplications of the 2021 guidelines that are just striking, right? Like I will see providers claim data credits for x-rays that they're billing as part of the same visit, you know, not even talking about any sort of independent interpretation. They're just saying, well, I have two x-rays, that's 2 points. And oh, by the way, I'm billing for these x-rays as well. And so, you know, I think getting back to that baseline, I mean, I agree with Stephanie, we should understand it by now, but being able to understand and receive that feedback, I think is really important.
Well, and I think one of the things that's been tough too with trying to adopt the new guidelines is that everyone's still in the old school mind perception that it's about the complexity of the patient overall. It's not about today's visit. It's not about the risk of today's visit. What we did on today's visit. Do I sound like a broken record? Because I feel like one. And it just, they're looking at it. Well, I'm a cardiologist and this patient's got CHF, hypertension, and CAD. So they're a level 5 just by walking in the door. I'm just like, are you kidding me? Or, you know, we get oncology is a big one where they say, well, I have a cancer patient. So again, they're level 5 just by walking in the door. But then you go on to read the note of the respective specialty note. And it says patient doing better today, patient's off chemo, patient's feeling well, they're back to activity of daily living, they're now walking, you know, a mile a week. And you see all these improvements, which is such a positive for the note. And it's such a good look for the physician. Unfortunately, the physician says, well, because of the diagnosis, they're still a level 5. And I'm just like, you have no argument here on that. Because today, the 2 chronic conditions or 3 or more, or 1 even, are stable. Look at the problems addressed. Look at the data points. You said that today they didn't need anything. So there's none. So now 2 out of 3, I didn't even have to go to the overall risk because I can't even meet that level 4. You know, I can only meet right now a level 3. So I go to the last one and it says, you know, if they're on certain medications, continue them. They give actually status of it. And then they talk about, they'll check in with their primary care physician. And my favorite thing that a lot of providers are doing is, oh, by the way, the patient needs to have their screening colonoscopy, they have their screening mammogram. I'm like, those are screenings. Those don't contribute to the problems addressed. So you don't even get credit for that. They're like, but that's medicine. I said, it's preventative. I said, it's a preventative insight. It's kind of like, and let's just talk about the COVID uptick. I see providers putting these generic statements in their notes that say, kind of a population statement, you know, get your COVID vaccine, blah, 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 whatever. And they're trying to say that's moderate for saying that. I'm like, no, if you've got a patient that has multiple comorbidities and you think that patient needs to have a vaccine for whatever reason, because they could be immunocompromised if they don't get it. And that's your opinion for that particular patient. And you document that because, again, what they're going through today, then you've got some argument there. But to put in these general statements thinking that that's going to get you something from an upcode. And then to Scott's point, that's the last thing I'll say on this, which kind of drives me crazy, is that we get these generic statements a lot. And I know people really like to say, well, the EMR is there to keep the provider from having to do too much paperwork, to, you know, patients over paperwork. So we put in these macros. And I don't know about the rest of the panel, but I see these macros all the time. 41 minutes. And I love the 41 minutes because it's 1 minute over the minimum time for a level 5. Every patient's 41 minutes now. It's like that Staples button. Can you imagine being in there 41 minutes with the patient? The patient still has questions going, no, I'm done with you. So basically they put these macros in there that say 41 minutes spent reviewing the chart noting, independent interpretations and reviewing outside records. Okay, so this is the macro for every patient. It's awesome. I look for that independent interpretation. Don't find it. I look for outside external records. Don't find it. You know, so what they're saying for their timestamp generically on every patient, by the way, doesn't even exist. So then you have to defer to medical decision making. So then you go through medical decision making and it's a struggle to get to even a level four, but you've got the physicians pushing back and saying, but again, the patient's got three complex conditions, even though they're stable. I said, continue meds. And because I did prescription drug management. So that's my 99214. And my head hurts from face planting. That's all I can say. It's really tough to have the conversation about what it means to manage, what it means to look at the overall risk and morbidity and mortality of this patient today. And Christine, I'm going to forever just really, you bug me because of that word. That's Christine's word. And then she got me to use it last year and now I can't stop saying it. So
well, no, but you're 100% right, Terry. I see a lot. I have a lot of dermatologists that I work with. And I see a lot of patients that come in to see the dermatologist. And of course, in case anybody didn't know, as we age, we get these spots on our skin. Just means our skin is tired in certain places, that it's either had too much sun or too much love or too much fun or whatever it is. And my,
you know, there's a game you could play, Christine. It's called Connect the Liver Spots.
Right. Exactly. Well, my dermatologists, they love to say, well, these are chronic conditions. The patient's going to have it for the rest of their life. But what are you going to do about it? Are you going to make this look lighter? Or like, is it going to, you know, hinder my overall health? Nope. Sunscreen. But we've got three chronic conditions here because they're all sunspots or, you know, cherry mangiomas or things that we're not going to treat because it's old lady spots. But because you have old lady spots, it's a 99214, 99215. That's crazy, in my opinion. It's almost like saying, well, if Sean Wise is going to show up, then automatically it's a 215. You know, that's really something. Or if Stephanie comes, it's a 213, could be a 214, but then if Paul's there, it's a 215. Come on, guys. This is insane. Honestly, it really has to do with what are we doing today? How are we taking care of this today? And if we're not, then it shouldn't count.
Well, there's one element that hasn't really caught up to the modern age as far as complexity, and that's the electronic medical record. For 26 years, providers got used to this idea that the more I produce, the higher the level I can drive. You know, if I give them a page and a half of history, and if I give them an 8-system, 9-system exam, then boy, oh boy, I've got myself a high level of service. And, you know, one thing that's still in the olden times, 2.5 years later, almost 3 years later, is that EMR templates have not been appreciably updated. There are some companies that are out there that have EMRs that are directed to a certain specialty that have been very good about updating their templates. For general, larger EMR companies, I'm not seeing that kind of update. I'm seeing, my favorite is Epic. Oh, just go to the Epic user web. Have somebody who's using the system answer your question. It's like, that's what I'm paying this six-figure check for in order to bring in your system, huh? Is to, you know, be thrown into purgatory with every other user of the system who can't figure it out. Thanks. But this, you know, when you're generating paper, that doesn't mean you're generating a level of service. It means you're generating paper. Make the paper say something of value to the patient's clinical condition.
Paul, wasn't there something that was put out recently that talked about it doesn't matter the volume of what you say, it's the substantive information. Right. And so, you know, I saw that in, I think it's in the Federal Register actually, but I mean, it's also in, and I know the Medicare manual, it's not the volume, it's what you actually do. But, and I know Scott, you've got something to chime in here, but just real quickly, I think AMA missed the ball and just totally dropped the ball when it comes to history and exam. The reason a lot of these practices are using their old EMRs is because they still believe that they need to have a history and exam to follow some kind of template. And since we don't have a standardized template right now, they're like, well, I'm just going to use what's in there. And then unfortunately, they threw in telehealth into the mix. So you've got these conflicting review of systems and exams where doctors are saying they're palpating masses, you know, they're checking all these things and they can't do that virtually. And so it's really kind of interesting. But yeah, go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, the last thing I wanted to add and just really build on what I think Christine was talking about is I think it's important that providers be educated on medical necessity and the reason that you're doing what you're doing based on the way that the patient is presenting today. And I think it speaks to a lot of the things that we talked about. And one of the challenges I find when I work in some health systems is that the provider training is really more centered on defining the threshold documentation requirements for different codes and not being focused on the medical necessity of the underlying problems. And I think this sometimes leads to situations where I look at a time statement documented in a note and I say, well, it seems very far-fetched for the quality of the documentation related to the presenting problem. Like this is a, you know, 31-year-old otherwise healthy person who has a sore throat and a minor cough, and you're telling me this is taking 34 minutes to get through. Or you have providers who, for whatever reason, are ordering, you know, and as a non-clinician, I tread very carefully in terms of telling providers what to do, but providers who are ordering extensive labs to work up problems where the patient doesn't even have symptoms related to the lab that they're necessarily ordering sometimes. And because they've been educated on these are the threshold requirements for the code level without being mindful of the necessity of the underlying presenting problem, the provider ends up coding these as higher level services. And in their mind, they say, well, I have met the threshold that was laid out to me, and it's almost agnostic to the quality of the patient's condition on that day. And I think it's a very tricky path to go down because in the provider's mind, they just say, well, I ordered this and I ordered this, and that's how I got to a level four. And, you know, while I'm not suggesting everybody would do this, I've certainly worked with providers or I've seen providers where the reaction to the training of two labs is a level three and three labs is moderate complexity, suddenly it's always three labs, right? And that's really not the intended solution. And I think it's important from a cultural perspective that it's focused on the medical necessity of the severity of what you're treating versus looking at the number of things that you're ordering and trying to paper your way to a level four or a level five service.
I see all the time, Paul and Scott, everyone I see, the copy pasting from visit to visit. Nothing has changed since the last time. Patient is stable. The physical exam, head to toe, unremarkable. And I spent 41 minutes, 99215. And when I questioned the providers, they said, well, we don't need to change it because nothing's changed since the last visit. Everything is stable. Well, then where do you really see that 215 factoring in here? If everything is stable, if you're doing a good job, the patient's where they're supposed to be, mission accomplished, they're always going to be a 215?
Well, I get, Christine, why are you looking back to check my work? I'm like, wait, what? They're like, I'm like, you asked me to audit your record. And they're like, record. We don't want you to look back.
And what possibly took 41 minutes?
I know.
In this exchange. I mean, I've never quite said this, but I've always wanted to say it where I want to like do a reenactment, you know, like almost like a Civil War style reenactment, but of the service. Like I'm going to come in dressed as the patient and you're going to explain to me how this two stable chronic condition visit where nothing has changed and I'm getting new meds took you 41 minutes.
Well, and one thing I try to explain to the physicians, I say, you know, I've been in this a long time, over 30 years. I said, and you know, actually close to 35 now, but I said, you know, a long time ago, before we had the 95, 97, all that, for those of you that have been in this long as I have, remember when we had 900-405-060, or it was just time. I don't care if the doctors talked about golf with the patient. If you spent 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, whatever, you got your time. No, there was no guideline of what you spent doing in there. That changed so many years ago, almost 30 years ago. And so there has to be substantive information to support what's going on today. And I just think it's tough, especially because all of us audit and review records and we educate. And we're seeing now that the TPE audits, the CERT audits, heaven forbid the UPIC audits, which they're really looking for an issue. They're really looking at that unbelievable day. They're looking at what the providers are doing to, and I hate to say manipulate the service, but you know, you give somebody an opening and saying, well, if you did this, this could look like this. They're going to do it because reimbursements are going down. And next year, looking at taking a Medicare, 3.5% reduction again, don't think people are going to try to get around it again. And I mean, even the new complexity code, that's going to be a nightmare for us, you guys, because they haven't defined it. They haven't told us how it's going to add on. They haven't said it's just for level five, like the prolonged care. And I can see now a lot of providers saying, oh, look what we get now, not realizing that's actually going to take money from other codes as well. But it's hard to really explain what a believable day is. And to everyone's point today on the panel, you know, 41 minutes, 38 minutes for these simple things that you do. And Scott, I kind of want you to reiterate what you and I had a conversation about a year ago, where you had a pediatric doctor say something about figuring out how terrible this was, and you related it to Little House on the Prairie, Dr. Baker. And yes, can you say that? It was really funny to me, and it keeps sticking with me.
Well, I think it was because the provider claimed that otitis media could be fatal to the patient. I said, yes, it was during Little House on the Prairie.
But
in reality, we just treat it, you know? Right. Like, Doc Baker didn't have, like, the meds we have now.
Right, in 1855. Exactly. It's like, people, look at what you're doing now, so...
Well, and the one thing I want to add to that, and I think this is important, particularly for internal auditors, is time statements have to be thoughtful and defendable. And I think sometimes there is this reflexive action that I see on the clinic side to say, well, the provider, you know, documented time, and it's almost like the provider gets to get on like a magic carpet and fly through the rest of the note and land at whatever service associates with the time. And that leads to a couple of things. It leads to the medically unbelievable day that Terry mentioned, in effect, because the provider, I don't think, is necessarily being malicious, but they're not being thoughtful about how all these 40-minute visits are stacking up across their like 20 and 30 patient day. And the second part about time statements is, again, the medical necessity. Like, I've had back and forths with clients where I have rejected a time statement, and the client is like, well, how could you do that? Like, the provider had said that they spent this much time. And I just said, well, that doesn't make any sense to me that the documentation that they produced for that presenting problem justifies like that level of time. Because if we're not willing to go down that road, we definitely are taking on that added risk of the provider just saying like, look, if I just say everything's 30 minutes, 34 minutes, 33 minutes, I'm just going to rack up level fours all day, and I don't have to be thoughtful about what it is I'm actually managing.
Yeah, remember that. Sean.
No, go ahead. I was just saying, I think that's a great point that Scott was making, but go ahead, finish your thoughts.
No, I was going to remind providers that the medical record is still, we need pertinent clinical information. So you can't say patient presents with hypertension, spent 41 minutes. Doing what? Because 3 months from now, 6 months from now, how are you going to remember that you changed their medication or you referred them out or that they were doing better, but they're not quite at goal yet? How are you going to remember that 6 months from now if your documentation simply was, he prayed for follow-up, refilled meds, 41 minutes.
It's a very, very good point. Let's go around the horn and let's give some final thoughts. Terry?
I want to ask Christine, why does she already have a skull on her table and skeletons on her chair behind her? Halloween?
Well, the skeletons on the chair were always there, but I found this super cool skull. You can't see it, but it has...
Oh, no, I can see it.
No, but it has all of the bones.
Oh, okay.
I thought that was so super cool to help me with my neurology coding that...
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, so...
I was going to say my skeletons are still in the closet. Sorry, I had to do it.
And on that note, we will not be going to Scott Kraft for any final thoughts. So I will go to Paul Spencer first.
Well, I'd just like to reiterate that the, with regard to EMRs and particularly big Cadillac-like EMRs that are not giving you any help on templates, at the very least, could you update your active problem list? Because it's a very good chance that your patient has not been suffering from that fractured ankle that he had in 2003 in present day, unless it was one doozy of a fractured ankle. So it's the little things that make a lot of difference.
Well, isn't that a big deal too for HCCs? That's not my wheelhouse, but doesn't the Medicare Advantage plans, you have to be really careful about what you put as active?
Absolutely.
Yep.
That's what I thought.
Yep. Stephanie, some final thoughts?
Yeah, so this may seem like an obvious comment, but it's not obvious in my audit findings. If you're doing the work, if the scenario fits the level, we need to see it in documentation. So one of the things I talk about with the providers I work with in trainings or one-on-one is that if you're looking to a level four, if you're looking to a level five, we're not going to get there if we don't have free texted documentation, because I can't make any assumptions and put the pieces together for you. So I can see that maybe a scenario exists that's more concerning, but we've got to be able to see what's happening behind clicking an ICD-10 code, clicking some orders. And one last thing, I just spent some time in Salem this last weekend, so I am ready for Halloween, and mine will probably be coming out this week. All of my skeletons and decorations.
Christine, final thoughts.
So we need to remember that when we're leveling a service, we're leveling a service based on what that patient's got going on today. We're getting reimbursed based on how much work needs to go into it today. So oftentimes when I see a level four or a level five, I'm expecting to see a change in the plan of care. We're increasing a medication, adding a medication, maybe decreasing it, maybe adding a test, maybe referring them out. I'm seeing that more work had to come into play today. The other thing I want to remind you, again, we're getting paid today. So when you hire me, do you want me to charge you for what could be the worst case scenario 6 months from now? Or do you want me to get reimbursed for what I'm doing for you today?
I like that. Good point.
Fair enough. Terry, final thought?
Yeah, one of the things that we haven't mentioned today, just real quick, is try to also realize that certain minimalistic entries into the record, patient has been smoking 5 packs of cigarettes, a day for a week. We've told him to quit. That's not smoking cessation. Okay. I see that all the time. Somebody's trying to charge extra, or the patient's coming in, their husband is sick, and they say patient told me they were feeling a little depressed because their husband's sick and they're a caretaker. And all of a sudden I see an add-on code for, counseling under depression. I'm like, whoa, where is the counseling? The patient told you something and you moved on. So be really careful with that. I see people trying to do all these add-on codes saying that I did work and they didn't. And Kushan,
all right, Scott, I'm against my better judgment, I'm going to go ahead and give you a final thought.
No, I appreciate that. I did want to say, to Terry's point, I sometimes see smoking cessation billed where the note says the patient will never quit smoking and has no interest whatsoever in quitting smoking, which I always get a kick out of. But my final thought really related to a lot of the things I've said today. Is I think provider education should be centered on not getting to a specific outcome, but rather the process of documentation, what's important to document under the guidelines, and how that will yield specific codes based on the patient's acuity on the service date. I think too often it's just focused on like, this is what a four is, this is what a five is, not from a acuity perspective, but from a things perspective. And I think that results in providers feeling like they just have to document to the thing rather than focus on the patient's condition.
Great points. All right. My final thoughts are pretty straightforward, and hopefully they mean something. So today is obviously September 11th, and I would like to take a moment to send out our thoughts and prayers and well wishes to those of you who lost family, friends, in the horrific 9/11 catastrophe that our country went through so many years ago. They are never forgotten and always remembered. I remember where I was on that day, and no less than probably 50 or 60 phone calls were coming in trying to reach me because I was in Boston that day, boarding a plane, trying to get to my next city. And by the time cell service was restored, my BlackBerry, if you, for those of you who are old enough to remember a BlackBerry, just was going berserk. But to all of you who wear the uniform, to our first responders, our military men and women who look over us, who run into the disasters when everybody else is running away from it, we all thank you. We salute you. We appreciate you. And we love you and your family for the sacrifices that you all make each and every single day to keep us safe. All right. Terry and I are going to be back tomorrow on Tuesday, the 12th, with a brand new episode of Hashtag Terry Tuesday. I've got two really great podcasts coming up this week with two different physicians. One is Dr. Brian Fengler of Evidence Care, and the other one is Dr. Cynthia Ward, and we're going to be talking about artificial intelligence and its role in healthcare. So keep an eye out for those. I'll be posting them onto LinkedIn. I'll be posting them into, obviously, Anchor and iTunes, Spotify, and wherever you are able to download your favorite podcast episodes. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media at The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.